I am Tucker Perkins. I'm the president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. I also am host of the Path to Zero podcast. We have a great panel today. We're so excited to get into it. And I'll be moderating it. And the topic is achieving net zero with renewable fuels. Joining me today are three distinguished guests. First, Rebecca Grun. She's the CEO of Futuria Fuels. Very, very European focused with business all over the world. She'll tell you about that. Jennifer Holmgren, the CEO of LanzaTech, a most fascinating company that really has a great story to talk about carbon, how we use carbon and what we do with it. And then really on the practical side of this application, arguably the tip of the spear, Keith Kerman, the Chief Fleet Officer for the New York Department of Citywide Administrative Services. Really honored to have y'all here as our panelists. Before I turn over to the panelists and we get going, just one piece of housekeeping. We'll have an online chat forum for this event. You're welcome to submit your questions as they come up. We probably will not take them as the panelists are speaking. We'll hold them to the end. But if you do have a question or a comment, we invite you to submit them through the online chat forum. And with that, let me begin with just one other comment. We're here in New York to address a serious conversation, climate change. Climate change is clearly, I would say, the challenge of our time. Not one of the challenges, but the challenge. A lot of varying views about the solutions. What are the costs? How do we get there? And the way we're going to get to that solution is by solutions as we come together just like this, Climate Week, where we come with innovators all over the world and discuss ways that we can truly reduce our carbon efficiently in a cost-affordable way, perhaps impact our health positively, all of the things that will create not only a healthier planet, perhaps healthier people, and certainly one with which we can afford that. So great time to start with these three of our innovators. And eventually we'll hear from the New York City Chief Fleet Officer on a fascinating story about how the city is journeying from where they have been to where they want to go. But first, let's go to the panelists. If you would, please briefly introduce yourself, maybe what you do, and just one or two things about why you're here.
Thanks, Tucker. It's really great to be here. My name is Rebecca Grun, and I'm CEO of Futuria Fuels, which is a new business within SHV Energy's global network. So we distribute LPG, off-grid gas, to millions of people around the world. We have businesses in the US under Pinnacle Propane, in Europe under various different brand names, Kala, Primagas, Liquigas, to name a few, in India, Supergas, in Bangladesh, Petromax, and in Brazil with Supergas Brass. So we distribute gas in all its forms, from cylinders, tanks, bulk tanks, and for transportation that are used for domestic heating, industrial process heat, cooking and transport. So it's a really broad range of applications, but Futuria Fuels is trying to make sure that we can continue to serve those customers that are rural, off-grid, temporary and remote with increasingly lower carbon and renewable and recycled carbon alternatives.
Thank you. Jennifer.
My name is Jennifer Holmgren and I'm the CEO of LanzaTech. And what we do is we recycle carbon. We take carbon in all of its forms and convert it to products such as ethanol, sustainable aviation fuel, polyester, etc. The point is we believe very firmly that there's enough carbon above ground that can be recycled and converted to the things we need, keeping carbon firmly in the ground. How do I link to what we're doing here, what we're specifically talking about? We're working with Futura, we're working with Rebecca specifically and her team in figuring out ways to recycle carbon to make basically LPG so that we can serve her industry by using recycled carbon products.
Great. And Keith, I know it's a really tall order your job is a tall order to me, but as you think about transitioning this fleet, so not only I want to hear about you and your job, but I would love you to talk to us about the fleet and, you know, kind of your ambitious efforts to decarbonize.
Okay, thank you, Tucker, and on behalf of Mayor Adams and our Commissioner DCAS, Don Pinnock, thank you for having us here to kick off Climate Week. So my name is Keith Kerman. I'm the Chief Fleet Officer for the City of New York. We're the largest municipal fleet in the United States. We are vehicles that everybody in America knows. We're the New York City Police Department and the Fire Department, Department of Sanitation, Department of Transportation, Department of Parks. If you think about just core services that everybody in the world needs every day, we operate the largest version of them in the world. And we have a lot of vehicles that are critical to that, just from sanitation trucks to police cars to bucket trucks for forestry, and it goes on and on. On the environmental side, while we need our vehicles to provide these core and critical services throughout the city 24 hours a day, we also want to do so in the most sustainable way possible and to lead the way in sustainability. So we've committed to an all-electric fleet by 2035 for light and medium duty units, including policing, by 2040 or when available for heavy duty and specialized trucks. We already operate nearly 5,000 electric vehicles. We already operate the largest single operated charging network in the United States, over 1,750 charging ports. And we've committed to greenhouse gas reduction of 50% by 2025, which is not far away. And we think we will make it.
And that was measured from your base what year?
The base is 2005.
Yeah.
I will say I came into this role in 2011. And prior to that, they probably didn't have the best fuel and emissions reporting. So I always say, well, if we created the whole emissions reporting program in 2012 and 13, how exactly are we comparing to 2005 baseline? But in the end, it's not going to be, we're not going to need the margin. We're rolling out a program that's not going to be within dispute.
Ambitious goal, nonetheless, for sure. All right, let's start maybe by just asking a couple questions to each of you, but I'll just try to let you begin to think about it. First off, just very big picture, in your own world, what keeps you up at night? And maybe the other piece of that is, where do you see a really positive success, or maybe where do you see missed opportunities? And Jennifer, maybe I'll just start right with you in the middle.
What keeps me up at night? A lot of things, actually, but the one
you're,
that...
You're running a public company. Yeah. Here, so I can only imagine.
Yeah, but I'm going to go with, for the focus of today, what keeps me up at night is calls to inaction. We spend a lot of time worrying about solutions and what's the perfect solution, and we overthink the problem, and every time we're overthinking the problem, we're not actually doing something to solve the problem. Every carbon atom that ends up in our atmosphere or ends up in our ocean is a problem, and we fundamentally need to work on solutions that will help reduce that. So when somebody has an idea that's basically a unicorn that's going to be ready 20 years from now, that's brilliant, but it stops us from actually doing things now. And there's a lot of legislation and other things that are so focused on perfection that they don't enable the practical solutions that are available today that help us a little bit and that get us going from happening. So that, to me, is my biggest concern.
Yeah, great. Rebecca, what keeps you up at
night? I'm definitely the pursuit of unicorns, and actually potentially in a lot of cases, policies that don't even realize that the unicorn is going to be great in 20 years' time, but it's actually not solving a problem today. And so when we try and think about how we can really support all of the different applications of energy, all the different consumers around the world with something affordable, safe, easily transportable, and available right now, there's no time to be thinking about what could be or what might be somewhere down the road. So it's really that realization that we need to do the right things now, as well as developing and continuing to evolve all of those. So I think the policy angle, which you also asked in the question, if I may, just rather than all doom and gloom, there are some lights at the end of the tunnel. There are some places around the world that are seeing now that we need immediate solutions, and that we also need to look at a very holistic approach to how we deliver energy to all the people around the world. And I think that gives me hope that we will get there. There are good examples in India, good examples in Europe, good examples in the US. So there's different ways of going about it, and each locality, each country, each community will have a different solution based on what resources they have and the uses and the infrastructure that they've built up.
I'm going to give you a chance to answer that, but I want to go to my next question and I'll let you back into that because I don't really want to know what keeps you up at night.
My 14-year-old.
I worry about
it. Well, I said light on in his room. It's 2 a.m.
But I do want you to talk about maybe where you see great gains that have been made. You've already talked about a little bit in electrification, but also perhaps where you see some missed opportunities or something that's not perhaps moving quick enough.
Well, you know, I was going to answer the other question. I mean, I'm trying to electrify, and New York City is trying to electrify, in a place you could argue should go last. We're trying to go first in an emergency services environment, right? So police, fire, sanitation, those are all emergency uniform responders. These are critical operations. They cannot shut down, and our first and foremost mission is not to electrify their fleets. It's to make sure they have reliable fleets that can serve New York. So things that we have to take on as challenges are things like, as you electrify, what's your backup power solution? What happens when you have an all-electric police or sanitation or fire fleet and there's a nor'easter and the power goes out 2 hours into it, right? These are challenges now we would solve with diesel generators and, you know, we keep everybody on the road. Big additional challenge. What about IT security? What happens if you create this big charging network and you're now dependent on it? Not just our fleets, right? When an Amazon, a postal service, all these critical fleets that are so core to everything we do in our lives, now they're going to be dependent on electric vehicles. What happens in charging? What happens when the charging network gets hacked or ransomware? Is that a new way you can shut down core services by going after the IT protections of a charging network? So these are things, and the last one I'll say, just going to what keeps you up at night, we have to make this progress on environmental issues, and it's critical, and I share the belief that it is absolutely essential to all of our futures. But we have to do so while tackling all kinds of other big crises that keep coming up, right? So COVID, right? An extraordinary challenge in everything that we are doing. We're dealing with an enormous crisis right now in New York City involving immigration. Hurricane Sandy, right, when we were hit by a major hurricane, which is what we're trying to prevent. Right. But these issues become the focal points of municipal government life, the focal points of resource. Sometimes they take away resources. So we need to make progress on these environmental issues for the short and long term while dealing with the major emergencies that are happening every day that we have to tackle.
Anything that we're not doing that you think we should be doing faster?
Well, there's lots I'd like to see happen faster. I will say there's been enormous progress, right? Just about 15 years ago, there was a documentary, Who Killed the Electric Car, right? So the whole industry was in such dire straits that the most creative thing happening with it was trying to capture its demise. Now, we're almost in the opposite, right? Everyone thinks electric cars are inevitable. They're Thanos, if you follow the Avengers. And that's not true either. But there's been a lot of progress, especially in the light and medium duty side. I will say we need a lot more progress in the heavy duty side, right? I can Google and everybody will tell me that heavy duty trucks are there and there's a return on investment and it's all great. You know, real big cost increases when you try and go into heavy duty trucks, limitations in range and operability. We need to see the same thing that happened in light duty, that's happening now in medium duty with pickups and vans, happen. A lot of investment, a lot of improvement on the heavy duty side. Heavy duty is where the cost is. It's where the emissions are. The diesel fuel is what you need to get out of. But we need to see a real big advance in capacity, options, models, costs on that trucking side if we're going to get where we want to go.
So, Rebecca, that's a perfect segue to you because I think you perhaps can offer a solution, right? And so let's begin to talk about how the advance of zero carbon renewable fuels and where that fits in. So talk to us about that.
Well, yes. Yeah, so I think that the immediate solution, using the infrastructure that we have, using all of the fleet that we have, and replacing the fossil molecules with molecules that have been made from biogenic, organic, and recycled carbon molecules, makes a hell of a lot of sense. It means that we can do things right now. We can offer an alternative, a drop-in solution. So with propane, we have renewable propane, or bio-LPG, as we call it in Europe most of the time. And RDME, or dimethyl ether, which is a very similar molecule that can also be made on purpose. We're doing a lot as an industry, and the last couple of years have seen a huge growth of projects and developments in that area, which is really exciting. of course it's not going fast enough, of course it's not yet cheap enough, of course it's not yet available enough, but the realization that it's possible and that we're doing it is getting out there, and that's really exciting. What we need to now do is just make sure that we focus on using all of the different feedstock that's available, so the waste streams, the non-recyclable waste streams that really have no other value other than being a emission or a problem for our society, and make those into something valuable that can be used as a really viable drop-in solution today.
And renewable liquid fuels, sustainable jet, renewable diesel, renewable propane, renewable DME, excellent for transportation, primarily aimed at medium duty, heavy duty, right?
Yeah.
And then to a degree, airline, fairly difficult to electrify, I think. And then quite a few other difficult to decarbonize sectors. What do you want to add in? You've got a really unique view on carbon. Do you want to add in maybe where you see some of the opportunities for renewable fuels?
Yeah, absolutely. Although the first thing I'll say is I'm glad I don't have your job. That's the one thing I realize. I sleep a lot better because I don't have your job. But, you know, we've spent a lot of time on making sustainable aviation fuel. I think at the end of the day, there are certain fuel requirements that, for long haul, shall we say, that require energy density, right? So putting a fuel on an airplane that allows you to fly from Cincinnati to Cleveland isn't going to get it done. We need to be able to go across the oceans. And so we spent a lot of time developing approaches to recycle carbon emissions, convert those emissions to sustainable aviation fuel. In my mind, that solves two problems. It keeps fossil carbon in the ground, but it also creates an alternate path to aviation fuel. I also want to make a comment that does relate to your job, because I'm sure you worry about airports as well. One of the things that I want to always remember is that we focus sustainable aviation fuel on greenhouse gas emissions. But the reality is that these fuels that we're making are hydrocarbons, which means they burn cleaner than conventional kerosene. They don't have sulfur. They don't have particulate emissions. And because they don't have particulates, they don't have contrails. They don't result in contrails. So I think we also have to ask ourselves, are we duplicating our current carbon economy, or we're trying to create a better one that is cleaner, not simply from a greenhouse gas perspective, but also from the other emissions that we've grown used to and have come to accept? And so that's what I would say on renewable fuels, or whatever we want to call them. We have the ability to use power, electrons, hydrogen, whatever. The bottom line is, what is the carbon economy we desire? What are we walking towards? And will it make our entire ecosystem better beyond greenhouse gas reductions?
And just, if I may, just because I totally agree that the air quality impact of whatever we can do to improve what we had is saving lives today in places where that exists. So it's not a small additional benefit for us as a society. It's fundamental to how we then build up what we want to achieve.
Yeah, so I'll just weigh in. We are obviously as focused on the air quality issues as the greenhouse gas issues. I have an apartment on York Avenue, and I have young children. So I often remind myself that we have a four-lane highway on one side and a four-lane highway on the other side. Yeah. And if you took everything else away and just had our apartment and eight lanes of traffic, it wouldn't seem like, you know, it would seem like a challenging place to have people in terms of the emissions. So air quality, extraordinarily important. Now, what we're doing to reach 50 by 25 is really a three-part plan. We've published it in the NYC Clean Fleet Plan. But it's electrify everything you can as quickly as you can, right? Zero emissions is the best, and you can get a lot of cost savings and the maintenance and the fuel and longevity of vehicles. So where it's viable to do it. Still invest in hybrids and design efficiencies, right? So as we do our first work in electric police cars, and there are a lot of electric Mach-Es out there that you'll see in the streets now, we're making sure that all the other police cars go to hybrid. Right, so a lot of issues we still have to work on the electric side, but the others go to hybrid. Every ambulance in New York City has an alternative power unit that functions essentially as a hybrid plug-in unit today. So you can make progress even on an extraordinarily challenging operation. And then the third is biofuels, renewable diesel, biodiesel. We've been using biodiesel in city fleet since 2005, one of the largest users of biodiesel. Every truck today has some blend of biodiesel. Every building in New York City, public and private, has some blend of biodiesel. And we did a 1 million gallon pilot of renewable diesel, and that's growing that, which is something we're working on, is going to be a big part of how we get there. So three parts: electrify as soon as you can viably, still look at hybrids and efficiencies, and then for all that diesel fuel that we have left, get rid of fossil diesel, go to not perfect, but a lot better renewable biofuels that are really good on greenhouse gas, that are better at the tailpipe, not perfect, but better. And that's kind of our three-part plan and how we're going about it.
So I was going to ask you, but I think you just answered it very clearly, that you do see renewable liquid fuels as a part of the solution until EV provides that perfect solution, whether that's 10 years, 20 years. You said earlier, actually, you changed the words a little bit. You hope to be all electric by 2040 for vehicles where there are electric options, right? That's where renewable fuels can come in.
Absolutely, and that's where they will come in. So to give you an example, we operate about 3,000 vehicles, trucks, that are part of the core plow fleet, most at the Department of Sanitation. And a large percentage of those are the core 25-yard garbage truck. Now, we have brought in electric models from the garbage side, and for routed garbage routes, the electric did pretty well. But we have to plow the streets with those units, right? So there's not an electric option that can plow anywhere, right? There's no gator, there's no pickup, there's no garbage truck that can plow. Well, plowing is a really important thing. It's one of our most fundamental requirements, and it's a very sensitive city operation. You got to do it right. Fire servicing, right? So our fire department is challenged like no other, and we were talking about earlier, since we're right off the anniversary of 9/11. We have to provide fire equipment that meets the specs and requirements of the New York City Fire Department. So that means if we try to electrify that, we have to meet all their specifications and requirements. There are no fire service trucks that can do that yet. They're starting to develop some. There are some early models, and we're looking at that. But we're going to have to wait a while before you can transition these fire ladders and pumpers to all electric. And so while we wait, and there's a lot of other specialties, I will say that we published last year with the United States Department of Transportation, the Volpe Center, what we call a clean fleet transition plan. You can just Google it. It's a public document. And we went through for all 190 types of vehicles, 120 on-road, 70 off-road that we operate, what the electric vehicle status was. What's the condition of the market in terms of electrifying? So where we can electrify, we will. And there's a lot of opportunity. That's exciting. And we're buying electric vehicles whenever we can now. But where we can't, we want to go to these other two strategies, which are still very valid and important: hybrid and design efficiencies. And then for all the diesel fuel out there, off-road and on-road, we operate 5,000 off-road pieces going into biofuels.
Let me ask you, Rebecca, we talked a lot about, and you hear it there, where the first move is always towards electrification, and then mm-hmm. we'll think about the other options. Mm-hmm. Clearly, there are a lot of barriers as we think about the adoption of, I would say, zero carbon renewable fuels. Mm-hmm. And you're European. I followed that dialogue closely as movement to all electrification, now back up to the acceptance of renewable fuels, even a concept that we'll maybe talk later about e-fuels, right? Mm-hmm. So why are we having such a hard time telling the story and, to a degree, gaining acceptance, whether it's governmental acceptance or consumer acceptance, of renewable liquid fuels?
I think because it's not something that most people have thought about. Certainly, when you think about the global LPG industry, 200 million tons used for all those different applications every year, that's about the same size as the aviation fuel industry, and SAF gets a lot more press, as it were, than LPG. I'm a huge believer that we need SAF as well. We need sustainable alternatives, because I also have a pretty poor personal carbon footprint, having flown here today, but with compensation. But anyway, and with SAF anyway, the point is that we need to make sure that we understand what we're talking about. And from an industry perspective, looking at all of the different options, or for even from a country perspective, what is needed for all the different applications, that's a complicated story. You know, electrification sounds easy and like it's going to solve everything. And for all the things that it will solve, it's fantastic. But now I think a few years into this whole journey, all of us together realizing we do also need to make sure that there are solutions that work in the different applications that we have. So I think it's just a matter of time that we needed to continue to explain, raise the awareness of the role of something that's easy to transport, that's absolutely clean air quality producing, that is affordable, and that it is safe to transport and to use in all kinds of different scenarios. And when you think about that, you know, some of those off-road, off-grid, temporary, you know, seasonal agricultural applications are going to be quite hard to build an infrastructure for that's permanent, because it's just never going to make business sense. You need something that's movable, that's transportable, and that's, you know, there when you need it, and then goes somewhere else and does something else useful when you don't. So I think that realization is coming through, and that's starting, but that's probably, it is just a complicated message to tell.
Very complicated, sometimes too complicated. But also, do you think that most people just think of renewable liquid fuels as that traditional fossil fuel just wrapped in a greenwashed coat? Could it be that?
It could be that. And I mean, there is obviously...
Is it true? Could it be true?
Well, it could only be true if there aren't enough processes in place to make sure that it's not true. And in most places around the world, there are good agreements on how you ensure the traceability of the feedstock all the way through to the product. And that's, of course, not harmonized globally. We have various different systems, which doesn't help, actually, because it also means that some consumers are then confused if they look at something in one state in the US and then in another state in the US, and it'll have a completely different economic basis, for example, when the LCFS in certain states and not in others. You know, that from a consumer perspective, why should I not have the same right to opportunities or to financial benefit for that? So I don't think that's helped all of that, but I do think that the processes and all the benefits, you know, the now we can do a lot more with traceability. We can understand what the actual carbon intensity of feedstock and of the processes is, and make sure that we monitor that and measure that and give the consumer something that they can trust.
Excellent. Yeah, I think that's the world to which we're going, because I would have loved you to have said, no, it's clear that renewable liquid fuels have a place going forward, have benefit to the climate, to our health, we can afford them. And they're really hard to decarbonize things. I look at you and I think about a segment of your business you didn't talk much about, but your marine operations, ferries, workboats, massive opportunity to significantly reduce your emissions through the use of renewable fuels. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure one you're exploring. I already know just from the time we've been together, you're way ahead of me in those areas. Jennifer, let's talk about you for a second. I look at you and I see such a brilliant technologist and so many tools, you know, in front of you, certainly a leader, not only in America, but I think in the world, talking about carbon, good carbon, bad carbon. You specialize in capturing carbon and doing something else with it that we don't talk about much. But what are some creative ways to adapt industrial transportation, building systems, all those things that we talk about decarbonizing so that they too turn carbon into economic opportunity?
Absolutely. So you said the right thing, or at least the way we think about it. So I don't know if that makes it the right thing.
It is the right thing.
There you go. For the win. You know, when you think about today, we see carbon waste as a liability, right? And our view is that carbon waste is actually an opportunity. So if you have a steel mill and you're emitting carbon, which you are in most ways of manufacturing steel or cement, etc., taking that carbon and converting it to a product where you can create revenue in our minds, actually drives adoption of technologies, right? Because you're actually creating an economic benefit. What we do, I should actually stop, because you've talked about trash and sanitation, all these things. We can take a steel mill gas, a refinery gas. We can take gasified trash and convert it to ethanol, and take that ethanol and convert it to polyethylene, polyester, aviation fuel, marine fuel, et cetera. And so basically we're creating a closed loop economy. And to me, that's what good carbon is. Bad carbon to me is linear carbon. You take it out of the ground, you use it, you dump it somewhere in the air, in our atmosphere, in a trash pile. Good carbon to me is circular. Good carbon is how nature behaves. Nature reuses everything. Nature doesn't waste anything. And so it recycles carbon. That's what trees grow on, is carbon from the atmosphere. But it also recycles everything else. Nature doesn't throw away a seed. It becomes the next tree. If it doesn't become the next tree, it becomes fertilizer for the tree. So that's a different way of thinking. And I think the economic opportunity comes from not viewing anything as waste, but rather viewing everything as a resource from which to grow, from which to use something. Renewable fuel, materials, everything, everything in our lives can come from recycled carbon.
Do you have a path from putrescible waste to renewable diesel?
And we do.
It's an interesting thing.
There you have it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the issue often is about what feedstock easily gets to the best product.
Sure.
But you mentioned there, you mentioned in one breath, polyester.
Mm-hmm.
A few other non-fuels, and then you mentioned several liquid fuels. How do you determine where that carbon should go? Is it by the process, or is it by the economic in the game? What decides whether that becomes polyester or liquid fuel?
Quite frankly, it depends on who wants to buy it, because at the end of the day, this is not going to be at the same price point as conventional petroleum derived products, right? So it's about early adopters. I didn't bring it up, but I have an H&M sport move pair of pants that was made from recycled carbon emissions. And H&M move said, we want to try to see if we can use your technology. And I use it as an example because I think you have to have your mind blown by the fact that a carbon that was going to end up in the atmosphere as particulate emissions, as greenhouse gases, is instead in running pants, okay? Stop and think about that. It is possible. This is being done commercial. I didn't go to H&M Move. They came to us. They said, look, we want to do something different, and we like what you're doing. Aviation industry, ANA, came to us and said, we really like what you do. Rebecca came to us and she said, we like what you do. How do we apply it to our technology? So we don't have enough product right now. We have multiple commercial plants running, but there aren't enough to supply everything that's needed. Mm-hmm. What you always need is the early adopters, the people that are willing to say, I want to make a difference and I am willing to pay more and put that in my system to help you build more plants, because they know that the more plants we build, the cheaper it's going to get. It's like you said, we used to make fun of EVs, right? Because, you know, everybody always says, well, that's another 10 years out. It's the same thing with solar. In 2010, I remember reading articles about how solar was never going to happen. But the early adopters are the ones to enable the cost to come down so that you can get into the exponential part of the curve. So you can get to the part of the curve where then everybody can adopt a solution and it makes economic sense. So when I hear a city like New York saying, we're the big gorilla and we could stand back or we could lean in, and you lean in, I say, hallelujah. That's exactly what we need. That's what Rebecca's done and her team. You know, those are the people that make a difference. So who are my first customers? My first customers are the people that are leaning in and saying, we're going to work with you to make this happen. And then everything else will follow, because eventually it'll just make economic sense and nobody's going to have to lean in. They're all going to sit there and say, it's conventional wisdom. This is how we do it. This is how we've always done it.
Right. Keith, let me go to you for a moment. You've talked a lot about the fleet. You talked about electrifying. By the way, state your goal for us. You mentioned it really quickly. The name of your goal is what?
It's called the NYC Clean Fleet Plan. It's 50% greenhouse gas by 2025.
50 by 25.
And 80 by 2035.
And 80 by 35. And you get there, electrification as fast as you can go, and you're well on that path. Congratulations. It's amazing. Thinking about renewable fuels or hybrids, love that. As the mechanical engineers I work with, we firmly believe hybrids are a big part of the future for medium duty, heavy duty. What you didn't mention was hydrogen.
That's true. You
see a future for it today?
Well, hydrogen's an interesting conversation. It's not, you know, we don't have a lot of hydrogen sourcing right now.
It'd be difficult to get the right New York City area. Right.
You would want hydrogen that was sourced through renewables,
right?
So, you know, we would have a separate conversation about natural gas, but we aren't pursuing hydrogen and natural gas. You have major issues on hydrogen about new fuel infrastructure, sourcing of hydrogen, vehicle stock, right? So we have 190 types of vehicles. Very few of those have a hydrogen model.
Right.
One that I'm very sensitive to, helping operate 90 repair facilities, you would have to deal with code for repair facilities,
right?
So in the regular facility, we protect from the gas tank to the floor. Now you have to protect from the gas tank to the ceiling.
Right.
I'll bring you over to some of our older garages and look up at those balances, and you're like, oh, right, you know, that's not fireworks up there. So a lot of challenges. And of course, fire safety, an enormous challenge. So a lot of big challenges. I will say longer term, you know, as a fleet manager, I am very sensitive to some of the extraordinary potential benefits, right? Water vapor as your emission sounds great. An inexhaustible supply of your fuel sounds great. And hydrogen in the fuel cell has the potential to be a class one to class eight and off-road solution, right? So in that sense, at the fleet level, right, you would have a low maintenance solution with high range that can meet every, that is scalable, right? So right now in the electrification, we talked about light duty, it's great. Medium, it's kind of getting there. And heavy duty is still really a challenge, right? So hydrogen clearly could be a class one through eight off-road scalable solution, but a lot of these other challenges. So we always, we talk to everybody, we look at it. We tested the Toyota Mirai many years ago. So, you know, we never say no to anything, but right now it's not part of that three-part strategy, which is electrify, hybrids and efficiencies and biofuels. But it's not because we don't understand there's an extraordinary potential there. A lot of big infrastructure hurdles to get there, though.
And maybe wanting to be like the Vegematic salesman who now gets to say, but wait, there's more. Because these two panelists to your left are now working on what I would argue is the most cutting edge of renewable liquid fuels, and that is to find carbon, to find hydrogen, produce them different ways, put them together. So maybe you want to start by talking to us about electrofuels and kind of where we are today, the concept of that?
Well, I mean, I buy into the dream. Yes, it's fantastic, and the opportunities are definitely there. What we need to do, I think, is work out how we can make it scalable and cost-effective. And right now, that's not the case. So I agree you don't need it in your strategy right now, and we don't have it in our strategy right now because it won't work. You try and actually distribute hydrogen in a cylinder, you've really got no energy value in it whatsoever. So we need to think of other ways to do that. There could be an opportunity with e-fuels, and there's some exciting stuff going on in various different parts of the world where there is an opportunity, of course, to generate green electrons and no use for them immediately. That's the kind of place where you say that plus capture the carbon is a fantastic opportunity to make an e-fuel. And that's something that you can transport, you can use. You know, there's all kinds of different ways, hydrogen carriers of all different flavors that could be valued. I think the next 5 years are going to be really exciting in that space, in this space. We had recently some work that we've been doing with the Illinois Institute of Technology in this area. They published a really interesting paper in the Nature Energy. We're really excited about it. it's very early stage. So we're not just leaning in, we're kind of leaning all the way over, I think, in that sense, to say, come on, let's see what we can do. Let's see what could be possible. And there are places that it will make sense earlier than other places. I mean, in the Netherlands where I live, it's not going to be an immediate opportunity. We're too densely populated. We have too many other things going on to really focus on e-fuels right now. But there are other parts of the world where it makes much more sense.
Add into that, please, Jim.
Yeah, let's just making sure everybody knows what an e-fuel is, first of all. So E stands for electrons or electricity. So what you're doing is carbon dioxide has no energy, right? Carbon dioxide has carbon and no energy. So what you do is you pump it full of electrons. There's a couple of ways to do that. You can add electrons so that you can make carbon dioxide a molecule that can be converted. Or you can use those electrons with water to make hydrogen. And then the hydrogen is used to convert the CO2, right? That's another source of energy. So we can do it both ways. We can take CO2, pump it full of electrons and get carbon monoxide and convert that. Or we can take carbon dioxide and hydrogen and convert that to fuels. We can make sustainable aviation fuel for carbon dioxide and electrons. Is it ready today? We're going to make the same fuels, but we need cheap electrons. So if you look at the IRA bill, what does it do? It incentivizes production of hydrogen. So hydrogen can be used to convert the CO2. It incentivizes capturing carbon dioxide. And so now you've got incentives for carbon capture and reuse, and you've got incentives for hydrogen production. So these are things that are in the future, but it's very important to incentivize them today, because otherwise every new technology is 10 years out until you build enough of it that you get it down the cost curve. So having incentives in place that allow that to happen is super important. But again, let's be cautious that we're not just incentivizing the future. There's nothing I love to hear more than somebody saying, let's use existing infrastructure, or somebody saying 50 by 2025, i.e., I'm not waiting until 2050 to get my act in gear. These two things mean we have to do things that happen and are available today. We have to help incentivize things that will be available in 20 years. Both of those things need to happen in parallel. And that's where I see hydrogen. That's where I see e-fuels. They're going to make important contributions, but we need to get them down the cost curve. And we do that by starting today. And we're doing that. We do make e-fuels. We're starting to make sustainable aviation fuel from CO2 and electrons.
Well said. Really, really a great way to stop this conversation. Maybe turn now to see if the audience has sent in questions.
Okay, great. I think we have questions for all of our panelists. Keith, I'm going to start with you. There is someone on this panel who wants to know, how much progress have you achieved against your goal of 50% carbon reduction by 2025?
A lot. So there are some things we're working on now that we're not going to announce today, but we surpassed our original targets for electric vehicles. We are a little bit under 5,000 electric vehicles, and in the process, I'll go back to work and working on the next 1,000 order. We kind of need to be at that pace. We need to be over 1,000 replacements of diesel and gas vehicles a year going forward, and we're kind of at that pace. We've invested enormously in hybrids, about 4,000 hybrid vehicles that are not plug-in, and doing more of that, including on the police department fleet. I hear a police department vehicle behind me and reminding us that they're always watching. And we're going to do more on that front. And we are making a lot of progress on biofuels and hope to have more to say on that very soon. So we're confident at DCAS right now that we will meet, if not exceed, our 50 by 25 target.
Great. Thank you. I'll move on to the next question, which is also for Keith. What can be done to bring down costs of heavy-duty trucks without sacrificing quality and their emissions capabilities? Do you see any solutions happening anytime soon?
I see enormous progress in the electric vehicle industry, an enormous investment. I was out at the ACT conference. I think we were both out there, Tucker, a few months ago in California. And the amount of energy and companies and resources are extraordinary. And I happened to have spoken there 5 years prior. And it was a much, much smaller event. And so I come to this event, I'm like, oh, my God, where did all this happen? We're seeing expansion in vehicle models every day. Right, expansion in range. And we used to talk about 80-mile range. Now we went talking about 200-mile range. We're bidding at DCAS right now a contract where the minimum range level will be 350, right? So extraordinary progress. 3 years ago, I would have told you we had no electric pickups and vans. And that's a big issue for us. 25% of our fleet are versions of the electric of the pickup or van. Today, we are now operating 450 all-electric cargo vans and pickups with a lot more happening. So we're seeing that move forward. What I want to encourage and push is that same in trucking. And I do resist the idea that it's all there. And sometimes everyone says, oh, the trucks, we already have trucks. We need to see a lot of investment. We need to see better battery range. We need to see cheaper batteries. We need to see a lot more investment in the trucking side. I think that will happen. I want to remind everyone, you know, trucking is an enormous high percentage of the emissions that we have to conquer, right? I think it's, what, 5% of the vehicles and 25% of the emissions. So that's where we want to push the industry. We meet regularly with all the big truck manufacturers, all the big manufacturers in general, and we push for these changes. We are also working with the United States Department of Transportation. We're working with other fleets, public and private, through what we call the Clean and Safe Fleet Transition Plans, managed by Eric Richardson, our Deputy Chief Fleet Officer, who is in this room with us. So we want every manufacturer, when they meet with anybody, not just New York, when they meet with any fleet, public or private, to be hearing the same things. And so we're going to whisper in everyone's ears on the other side so that every manufacturer is getting pushed in these directions.
Great. Thank you, Keith. The next question is for Rebecca. You mentioned entities in India and China providing a light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to renewable tech for today and the future. Can you share some examples?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. Actually, just last weekend, the governments of India, Brazil, and the US launched the Global Biofuels Alliance. That is a really exciting recognition, them plus 14 other countries, industrial partners and international organizations saying, we need all the different solutions. So ethanol, SAF, hydrogen, biofuels of all sorts, renewable propane and RDME should be included in that plan. By coming together as governments, as industrial organizations and as industrial partners, we pool resources, we start thinking about all of those questions that we've talked a little bit about today on carbon intensity, regulations that kind of don't match up if you look at cross-border. All of the discussions about what color is the hydrogen, which is the wrong question, is mm-hmm. the wrong discussion. You know, it should be what's the carbon intensity of everything that we do and how do we make sure that we have circular systems in place to make the most use of all of the feedstock for the right relevant moves. So India specifically has had a really strong success both with using LPG as a cooking fuel that has saved millions of lives by that really visionary action, and also in their own blend of ethanol in their own domestic market. So two really important pieces of legislation that have had above the, or success beyond the original targets. And that's now leading to more and more. And they want to collaborate, of course, with other countries. And Brazil, I think, is another really exciting example where a lot of the activities are really around how do you build the value chain? How do you make sure that you have the right participation all the way through from the farmers? What's in it for them? What do they do with all of their agricultural residues? What crops do they grow? How do you make sure it's sustainable? What products do they then prioritize? And how do you get them, distribute them, to all of the different people who need all the different products and fuels in a very dispersed and quite challenging in a lot of ways to navigate country like Brazil. So those are two examples I could give. There are many more around the world. There are many, of course, here in the US as well. And we need more positive stories, I think, to kind of remind ourselves that there is opportunity to innovate when you start thinking holistically, working collaboratively, and circularly.
Is that a word?
Yeah, circularly. It is now.
It is now.
Okay, thank you for that response. The next question may be for Jennifer and or Rebecca. In the context of converting waste materials, both organic and municipal, into sustainable fuels, how do you intend to navigate the complexities of stakeholder ownership of waste, especially considering that waste management is often an informal practice in less developed countries? Given the increasing demand for sustainable fuels and the supply constraints with existing operators, how can you persuade these stakeholders to allocate a portion of their waste stream for sustainable fuel production?
Do you want to take that or do you want me to?
You can start.
Do it again. So globally, I think the figure is that we as a world produce about 105 billion metric tons of organic and municipal waste every year. That's a staggeringly large number. So really, I don't think we should be having a question, a discussion about is there enough waste? Yes, there is enough waste, and it currently isn't being valorized. So we really need to understand how we make that happen. The value chains, making sure that indeed the farmer or the waste management professional or the indigenous people, because in some places, that's actually how waste is collected and how things happen in a kind of relatively informal scenario. So that requires some thoughts about how you make sure it's in everybody's interests to do something better than they were doing before. It's not impossible. It's just looking at what happens now. How do you give some value in a circular format to all the people who have a piece to play in that chain or in that puzzle? And I think that that's something that we've certainly seen with all of the different places around the world. We're investing in a project in the UK, gasification of municipal solid waste to produce RDME. That's a huge advantage over landfill or some of the other options that have previously actually caused a problem in the UK. So we think that there is a good way of looking pragmatically, but also realistically at how you make all of those different pieces of the puzzle attractive.
And I would just add, we're doing a project to make sustainable aviation fuel from municipal solid waste in the UAE with Tadweer, which is the local collection company. And at the end of the day, there's nothing right now being done with the trash except landfill. And so this is actually a massive opportunity that is being driven by the company that collects the waste. So there's no other stakeholder involved. We're also doing a project in Southeast Asia where we're looking at manufacturing waste from the apparel industry and combining that with trash, with local trash. And there you've got, trash pickers, right? And so by creating a recycling approach with the trash and the post-manufacturing waste, what you're doing is actually creating sensible jobs for people that are picking trash, which is dangerous and toxic. And so what you're doing instead is giving them an opportunity to do something that is safer and gives them a steady job. So I actually think there are hurdles as this question cites. And what I'd like to say is, let's not focus on the hurdles, but the opportunities. The hurdles will eventually disappear when people see what other people are doing, right? Mm-hmm. And so really, we let the hurdles kind of be a barrier. And sometimes in a jurisdiction where there is a hurdle, then maybe that's not where you should start. Yeah. Work somewhere else. The whole world has trash. Yeah. And just find a place where your technology will fit nicely, where the reception is good for your technology, and do something. And eventually, it will all follow.
Do we have time for one more?
We do. One more, and it may be for you, Tucker. So I will pose this question to all of you. I'm curious about transitioning off of diesel generators for events like weddings, festivals, et cetera. What is the barrier to switching to renewables, and what would those renewables be?
Well, if you don't mind, I will take it.
Yeah.
And I love the question, because I think one of the things, as we talk about getting to a cleaner climate faster, elimination of diesel whenever we can in ports, in material handling applications, it is obvious. It's right there in front of us. It's there today. It achieves benefits to climate, to health, to your own pocketbook. Just such an easy near-term win. Now, you mentioned weddings and, those kinds of small portable generators. It's here now. And I think choosing conventional propane is a far better alternative than diesel today. And if you were in California, Oregon, Washington, Texas, perhaps, parts of the country, you have renewable propane accessible to you and zero carbon. So it's there. The generators are there. One of the beauties of these drop-in fuels, it doesn't change. It doesn't need a new engine. It doesn't need a new infrastructure. Where you used propane today, you use renewable propane tomorrow. And a great way to make a small and meaningful step forward in getting to a faster, a better climate in a faster way. So that's a great question. Thank you very much. Let me just thank you all. As I look over y'all, I want to thank y'all for being here. You have distinguished yourself and your company by being here at Climate Week. I'm just grateful that you spent an hour with us. I want to thank everyone who attended this important panel during Climate Week on achieving net zero with renewable fuels. If I could just summarize maybe the two or three things that I heard routinely. One, you hear from the tip of the spear, New York City, that there are solutions in place. No need to wait. You don't need to wait a year or 5 years or 10 years. There are solutions out there for you today. So acting today is in fact important. That was number two, act. Act today, act tomorrow, act a year from now. Don't need to wait. Perfect is the enemy of good. And you see it in every single one of these panels talk today. Act and act today. And lastly, I think that what you heard in this panel is choosing renewable fuels, low carbon, zero carbon, negative carbon fuels is a great opportunity to change not only the climate in which we live, the health around you, and do it in a way that's affordable and meaningful to you as a user. So three really valuable conclusions out of that. Thank you again. This concludes our presentation. A recording of this event is available at propane.com. I hope you'll go to propane.com. You'll find the page on the podcast, Path to Zero, and the recording will be available there. Thank you for being with us, and I hope you have a terrific day.